This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we hear from 4 days of drumbeat coverage from the Honduran capital as President Manuel Zelaya returns to the country. Our special correspondents Tim Russo and Andres Contreras report from inside the Brazilian embassy and out in the streets as Zelaya and his supporters take refuge while Honduran military and police surround and attack the building. We'll also get an exclusive interview from President Zelaya himself. And a new documentary film spotlights the Chevron Texaco destruction of the Ecuadorian rainforest and how indigenous communities are fighting back. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. The Night Report is off tonight. We focus our attention on the bold return of Manuel Zelaya earlier today to Honduras. At midday, in fact, today, 86 days into a coup d'etat in Honduras, President Manuel Zelaya boldly returned to retake the reins of power. 86 days ago, Zelaya was greeted by soldiers wearing masks and taken in his pajamas at gunpoint to the airport and then flown out of the country against his will. Today, in broad daylight, accompanied by United Nations peacekeeping forces, Zelaya re-entered Tegucigalpa and ultimately greeted the people from the top of the Brazilian embassy. Flashpoint special correspondent Tim Russo was on the line earlier today as Zelaya took to the roof and thousands of Hondurans flooded the streets in an unbridled expression of joy and relief. Here is Tim Russo.
Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras, surrounded by several thousand exuberant Hondurans that have received the news that Manuel Zelaya, as their president, constitutionally elected, that was has returned to Honduras. And we're trying to confirm as much of this information as possible, but the thousands of people went into the streets all throughout the center of Tegucigalpa. The United Nations building was surrounded by huge crowds of people, as the world was that Zelaya was in the United Nations installations there. Now the people in the streets that I'm walking with, several thousand are walking from the UN to the Brazilian embassy, where they believe that he might actually be. But we do have confirmation from Campesino leaders, Rafael Alegria, from Harry Dixon, one of the fiscals, the judiciary fiscals here in Tegucigalpa, that indeed Zelaya is in the country, just we're not sure in what building or where. So we're in the process of trying to find that out. Again, it's a sense of victory here for the people on the streets. We're hoping that this information, for their sake, is true. And we're following this as the story develops, hoping to be among some of the first to actually see Zelaya and speak to him when he addresses the nation and the capital here later today. We're being tightly monitored by helicopters that are flying overhead, and we've heard of a huge amount of movement at the Casa Presidencial, at the presidential palace, where Roberto Micheletti, the factual president, is believed to still be at the moment. We have not heard or been able to confirm what may have happened with generals Romero Velasquez involved with the June 28th coup, and we've not seen any other police presence on the streets except for one moment when the police tried to set up a security perimeter near the United Nations, and they were quickly run off by the multitude of the people that did not want the police or military forces anywhere near our streets because of the mistrust or distrust that they have towards those forces. They're saying they removed Zelaya from the presidency on June 28th. We're going to be following this throughout the day today, and obviously what else might take place because of what this implies, the presence of Zelaya back in the country.
We're speaking with Tim Russo. He is in the heart of Tegucigalpa, where it is now reported and been confirmed that President Zelaya came through the back roads, through the mountains, into Tegucigalpa, back into the country. Tim Russo, we are hearing from Eva Golinger that there was a conversation between Hugo Chavez and Zelaya when Zelaya was actually in the United Nations complex in Tegucigalpa. Had you heard about that?
No, we were outside of the United Nations building for the last couple of hours with the multitude, and it's been very complex to get great information. We did not hear that conversation, but we've been speaking to Zelaya's cabinet minister party members that were going in and out of the UN building. Apparently, his wife was also in the building, and we were looking for further confirmation from her, but she did not leave that building.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and that was Tim Russo, Flashpoints special correspondent, wonderful journalist who works with Free Speech Radio News, who has been on it for this program all the way through this 86-day military coup. It's still formally in operation, but as you heard, we were there with Tim Russo as President Zelaya confirmed for the people from the roof of the Brazilian embassy that he was back. He had come in and he was back to restore democracy. It was amazing. There was, in fact, dancing in the streets. The streets were flooded with every kind of person. Schools were let out to greet the return of the president. And obviously, this is a story that we have said time and again is crucial to the region and crucial to the world, that this kind of coup could not possibly be allowed to stand in this hemisphere after so much that we've seen over so many years. And we're going to keep the discussion going with somebody who knows a great deal about what's been going on, has been there during the coup, and Al Giordano is the founder and editor at Narco News, monitoring this through the day. I also want to tell everybody that we're going to be attempting to reach different reporters on the ground. We just heard from Andreas Tomas Contreras. He was just with the president. We're trying to make contact there, but it's difficult. The military apparently is somehow screwing with the communication system. Al Giordano, welcome to Flashpoints. This is definitely history, and do we think the president had the nod from the United States to do this?
Well, we don't know, but this has all the markings of a very well-executed and planned operation. That, you know, I mean, when I spent half the summer in Honduras and saw various small airfields, which each of them had a military delegation there and buses and vehicles blocking the runways. They were so afraid and of Zelaya's return. The border checkpoints as well. And so that he got through all that, it reminds me of the Von Trapp family in The Sound of Music, you know, crossing the mountains to get back into his country. And it makes fools of the coup regime, and it takes away the sheen of invincibility that they've tried to promote. They were caught flat-footed, and that the choice of Brazil's embassy for him to do this with permission of President Lula, the Brazilian Foreign Minister Celso Amorim personally welcomed Zelaya by phone call to, quote, Brazilian territory when he entered the embassy. And the regime now is trying to figure out how to deal with this. Meanwhile, it calls a curfew this afternoon, and people are disregarding it. They're mocking it. There are thousands already there in front of the embassy to protect their president, and thousands more coming down from the hills, coming in from the different states of the country, One caravan from the state of El Paraíso has already 2,000 vehicles in it, and that's a rather small state. And they're all heading there. The call has gone out in the popular barrios throughout Tegucigalpa for the people to come on down and surround that embassy and protect their legitimate president. Now, what the United States knew, or whether it participated in this, we don't know. All we know is that at the State Department press briefing this morning, when reporters asked about it, the U.S. was the first to confirm that, yes, Zelaya is in Honduras, at the very time when Micheletti, the coup regime president, was denying to the press, saying, no, our intelligence says he's not in Honduras. He's at the United Nations in New York. And any press that's saying he is in Honduras is committing terrorism mediático, no, media terrorism. And of course, so he ends up looking like an even bigger buffoon now that it's all confirmed. And that moment that Tim Russo so heroically documented for us is really a special moment in history.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're speaking with Al Giordano somewhere in the Americas, and he has been monitoring the situation. He has been in the country since the coup in Honduras. And let's just talk a little bit more about that historical significance of, no matter how this was engineered, that this victim of a coup, a duly constituted president, is run out, but they never come back.
Well, no regime fears a government in exile. That's what they want. I was talking with the Serbian resistance leader, Ivan Marovic, today about all this, just sort of strategizing the situation, trying to figure out what the next steps of the regime are going to be. And this presents a real problem for them, because he's in Honduras.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage of the bold return of President Manuel Zelaya to Tegucigalpa, to Honduras, to the Brazilian embassy. And we have been watching the story very closely. And joining us again, first from the Brazilian embassy, is our good friend Andres Contreras. He is with Flashpoints in Espanol. And I'm sorry, he is with Democracy Now! In Espanol. And he is talking to us from the Brazilian embassy. We also have Tim Russo from another location on the ground there in country. Andres, welcome back, and tell us what the situation is now inside the Brazilian embassy with the president.
It's good to be back, Dennis. The situation here has been one in which over the course of the day, there were about 300 people total here in the embassy. Many of them came here for refuge, really, from the political violence. And during the course of the day, the First Lady was able to negotiate their safe passage, and now there are about between 100 and 150 folks here at the embassy. There is a lot of concern about threats made by the either directly or indirectly by the regime that there could be an assault. However, very encouraging to hear that the response of the Brazilian government itself, and that they have officially requested an emergency meeting of the Security Council of the United Nations. Apparently, the United States is also part of that request, and we've heard that if we've heard that U.S. officials have said if there is an attack on this embassy by the de facto regime, the United States would consider it to be an attack against them. So that is somewhat encouraging. Because throughout the day, there was a lot of fear expressed, because the property adjacent to the embassy has been taken over by the police, and they are occupying it. And if they wanted to raid this embassy, they could easily do so from that neighboring building.
And now, in terms of the actual lockdown of the Brazilian embassy. So you're saying that the people in are in to stay, nobody's coming and going, and it is in fact surrounded by the military and the security forces.
Yes, it is definitely surrounded by the military forces. Visibly, there are usually around 50 soldiers and police, riot police, many of them masked. But what we know is that in the surrounding six-block area, there are hundreds and hundreds of others that are preventing any access to the embassy. Even some journalists have been turned away. So that really is creating an isolation feeling here. And I'm sorry, the first part of your question, Dennis?
Well, I just wanted to know if, in fact, it is locked down and nobody is coming and going.
Yeah, well, apart from this negotiated accord that the First Lady made with the police, a bus came here to pick up around 150 who were here, and they have now left. People are free to leave the embassy, but there's been a curfew, so it wouldn't be wise to be leaving, and they have prevented folks from coming here.
Now, let me ask you to just hold on, because I want to know a little bit more about what's been going on inside there, but I think we've got Tim Russo. Tim, are you with us?
I am indeed, Dennis.
Tim, where are you now?
I'm just outside of the Colonia Kennedy, where we saw some of the most recent police repression toward Pacific March that was taking place by the people of the neighborhood itself that was organized around 3:30, 4 o'clock this afternoon. The march took off, and at about 5 o'clock, the police came in pretty heavy-handed, as they've been doing throughout the course of the day in neighborhoods, marginalized neighborhoods, around the capital of the city. So we've been following that story throughout the day and trying to follow up on the detentions that have been taking place, including the fact that the police shot several canisters of tear gas into one of the main human rights organizations in Tegucigalpa, COFAL, the Committee of the Families of the Disappeared. That took place very early this morning as people were beginning to take refuge there to denounce what had happened, as they were violently displaced from the streets in front of the embassy, as Andreas just mentioned to us, at early hours of the morning around 5:40. So we've been here following that throughout the day, moving from neighborhood to neighborhood, trying to keep a tally of detentions, trying to keep a tally of those who've been released, and trying to get updated as well of new developments, like the Ian Kelly press statement that was made by the United States in saying that they were urging both Micheletti and Zelaya to immediately sign the San Jose Agreement to find an exit, political and diplomatic exit, to this situation here in Honduras.
All right. In terms of what do we know about the level of violence? What did you see? What have you been able to note, document, report in terms of the impact of the attacks and how many people were arrested, where they're being held, what we know in terms of the numbers that the police are saying they took in as compared to what the human rights activists are saying?
Yes, that's right. The police were saying both this morning and later this afternoon that their official numbers were about 150 people detained throughout the day in Tegucigalpa for either having defied the curfew, which has been reinstated until 6 tomorrow morning, that's been extended, or for being a part of the demonstrations that were in front of the Brazilian embassy, or demonstrations in some of the neighborhoods. What human rights organizations, COFARE, seems to coincide with CODE, as well as CIPRODE, the three major independent human rights organizations here in Tegucigalpa, they all come up with a number closer to 350 people that have been detained, with numbers as high as 36 different types of injuries, from broken arms to people that were being beaten at one point with sticks with nails in them by the police. And that doesn't include people that were affected really by tear gas, which are much, much larger numbers. Many people trying to do self-medication to get their breathing back. We saw ourselves several accounts of very old women in their early 80s that had to be carried out of the second floor of a house because the police had shot tear gas through the windows of the house in a marginalized neighborhood there. In that same raid on the marginalized community called Pacho, there was several women that were carrying young babies less than a year old through the streets trying to get away from that burning sensation and the asphyxiating sensation of the tear gas that was very liberally used by the police in order to get people off of the streets or out of the streets. Really, when the people would see journalists in the area, they would become very exuberant to have their voices heard by the world, that they were there expressing their rights to say, we want Mel Zelaya back in the country as our president. And so they had very little fear to the police at that instant. And the police took a very belligerent stance and repressive reaction to that by being very liberal, again, with the amount of tear gas that they were enveloping these colonias in. And this is taking place in, I believe we have documented, at least 8 different colonias, including the 2 largest, Kennedy, which was the most recent, and Ato in Alto.
Were they going after journalists? Did you get? Did you come under attack?
A group of journalists that I was with, we became under verbal attack at 2 points during the day. The early point by the police and military that did not want us to reach the Brazilian embassy as we were trying to get there around 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning, shortly after the repression took place there. We were told to leave the streets at that point. We came back around, bumped into some of the same officials that recognized us, and finally were able to get authorization from higher-level military and police officials, including the spokesperson to the National Police, who stated to us that international and national journalists were free to cover anywhere and move freely, even with the curfew throughout the city, except for the 100 meters that are completely cordoned off in front of the Brazilian embassy. Now, what we saw a second time was later this day at the same scenario that I had mentioned earlier in Picacho, where the police were shooting tear gas at people in the streets there and in their homes. They turned directly towards us and said, let's shoot at those journalists over there. They didn't shoot directly at us, but when we were sort of in the midst of things, we could see that they were directing their tear gas canisters in a very specific direction, more towards us than the crowd, either to get us out of there or to send us a clear message that we're being considered a part of the resistance by putting their voices out on the air internationally and nationally.
My name is Dennis Bernstein. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. And we continue our coverage of the history-making stalemate that continues to unfold in the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras. President Manuel Zelaya, who re-entered the country dramatically through the mountains and walked into the capital city, remains under siege in the Brazilian embassy, where he has been given protection and refuge. The embassy continues to be surrounded by Honduran troops loyal to the coup government. In response to Zelaya's return, the coup government has attempted to institute various states of siege and emergency policies, including a dawn-to-dusk curfew, which was briefly lifted today. Well, it's back. In one moment, we'll go live inside that Brazilian embassy for a special report on what's going on. But first, we followed Flashpoint special correspondent Tim Russo through the streets of Tegucigalpa today as thousands of resistance protesters continued to march in support of Zelaya and the restoration of democracy.
This is Tim Russo in Tegucigalpa. We're following the march of Zelaya supporters and people demanding the resignation of Roberto Mexico, the de facto president of Honduras. The march started approximately 10:30 this morning at the Pedagogical University Francisco Morazan, has made its way into the center of Tegucigalpa, slowly but surely negotiating with the special police forces, the COBRAs, that are in charge of the operations here today. We are right now about one block and a half, at least ahead of the march is about a block and a half from the United Nations building here in the capital, which is about five blocks up further to the Brazilian embassy, where Manuel Zelaya continues to be holed up by a 500-meter police and military perimeter that's been established since when he arrived here on Monday. The demonstrators, Rafael Alegria from Via Campesina and others, leaders of the popular movement here, continue to negotiate with the police. Right now, there's a bit of a standoff. There hasn't been any repression as of yet, in part because the size of this demonstration, the size of this march. It's hard to say exactly how many people are here, but there are, we can safely say, are tens of thousands of people that came out despite last night's curfew, despite last night's serious conflict in many of the marginal barrios around Tegucigalpa. He spoke with an official in charge, Official Diaz, is in charge of the operation here this morning. He said there hadn't been any detentions last night, although human rights organizations say that's not the case. Right now, I'm just between a line of demonstrators, Official Diaz, and the special forces right here, just trying to cut off another splinter group that had been dispersed earlier in the day from the back of the march and is trying to regroup with the rest of the demonstration. So we have folks kind of coming out of many different streets in the center of the city. It's a bit disconcerting, I believe, for the police who have all placed their gas masks on. And again, we have two police vehicles here that have the high-powered water cannon that they use mixed with some sort of burning pepper type of chemical. At this point, we're going to follow this, see if this develops, see if any sort of repression or attempt by the police to disperse people here takes place. Again, Official Diaz, who's in charge, has said they really didn't want to do that, but we'll have to see. That was the police line, and what we can see is that the police have still been somewhat aggressive, not this group in the front of the march, but rather those that the demonstrators passed on their way towards the United Nations building. The people do seem determined to make it to the United Nations building to have their demand heard, and we'll just have to see if that happens. This looks like it's going to be a relatively intense day. We don't know what might happen in the colonias afterwards, as many of these people came from the marginalized barrios. You can expect that if there is some sort of repression on the streets here in front of this very specific pacifist march, nonviolent march, then there probably be skirmishes throughout the afternoon and the evening time as people begin to go back into their barrios and control their barrios. And we don't know if there may be some sort of reprisals as well at that point. So we're going to keep you up to date with how things develop here in Tegucigalpa in the center of the day, throughout the day, and we'll be in touch. Tim Russo from Tegucigalpa. This is Tim Russo in Tegucigalpa again. When we last reported, we had a standoff between the police and thousands of demonstrators that were trying to make their way to the United Nations building in the center of Tegucigalpa. After about an hour and a half in the very, very hot sun, the demonstrators began to slowly dispersed, changing their route towards the center of the city, looking to go towards the Central Park, at which point the police received a rock or two that was thrown at them, not by the center of the march, but a couple of people that were straggling, and the police began to shoot tear gas into the crowd, rubber bullets into the crowd, and disperse people to get them out of that zone near the United Nations. At this point, we're on the street trying to see if the march is actually going to regroup, if they're going to regroup in the center of the city near the Congressional Building, which is two blocks from the Central Park, or if this is the end of today's organized activity. To say that we're reaching the cathedral now. I'm a little out of breath, but that's from the hills in the center of the city, and it looks like people have indeed begun to regroup here. We're about six blocks from where the police broke up the crowd about 25 minutes ago. So it looks like people are beginning to regroup. We'll see how many people actually come back to this area at the cathedral, if they stay here or if they begin to decide this is the end of today's activities. We'll keep you posted as the day goes on, as events develop here in the city. Hopefully nothing more does take place, and hopefully things remain in calm. But we'll be following the events here in Tegucigalpa.
Was anybody hurt, Tim?
There was one man that was the very last man sort of standing in front of the police, taunting the police a little bit. The police seemed that it was fit to shoot about six rubber bullets at him, knocking him on the ground. When he stood back up, he was knocked on the ground several other times. The police went for him, and he found the adrenaline to get off the ground and go quickly out of the area. As far as other injuries, we haven't been able to report on any other serious injuries as of yet.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Andres, are you there?
Yes, it's good to hear you, Dennis, and also to hear the report from my colleague, Tim.
Well, I'm glad that you had a chance to have a shower. Set the scene. You are still inside the Brazilian embassy, and it is still surrounded.
Exactly right. I am still here. There are some 120 others inside the embassy. It is very much surrounded. I am now at this point looking at about a platoon of both police and military. Many of them are masked. They don't want to reveal their identity. This represents a very small amount of the number of both police and soldiers who are in a six blocks area, preventing anyone from approaching here. There are a few who were able to come to the embassy entrance, including Andres Pavon from the CODE, the Human Rights Committee of Honduras, the NGO. Andres Pavon was not allowed by the police to come actually into the embassy compound. The reports here with President Zelaya denouncing the widespread repression around the country by this de facto regime. President Zelaya has heard that there are some 10 who have been killed, and a number of those are disappeared, and the police are not reporting on them. The president is also denouncing attacks on the embassy itself with sophisticated technology, including high-frequency beams of energy that are being targeted toward the embassy. This is the president who has received information, and he had photographs. I was able to see photographs of very sophisticated electronic equipment that looked like huge satellite kind of contraptions very near the embassy. So it's clear that something has been going on. I can testify that I've been in the room of the ambassador's office, actually, and which is where the president spends much of his time. I spent much of the day there, and for a great period of time, there was no cell reception whatsoever. So it's very, and then all of a sudden, it does return. This is very symptomatic of the psychological warfare that's being done against the embassy, and it's been the pattern of this regime throughout the entire 88 days since the coup. And what it does is it keeps people off track. You never know when the repression will be increased, and it always keeps folks on the edge. The same has happened with turning the electricity on and off here at the embassy, or the flow of water, or allowing food and medicine in. At times it is permitted, and then at times it is blocked. So because there's no constancy, then it doesn't give a lot of validity to ongoing repression. But it's hard to document the fact that it does take a toll in terms of psychological warfare against those of us who feel it.
Is there now a routine developing? Is there a process? What exactly is happening inside the embassy? How is it functioning? What role is it playing here, there, in Tegucigalpa, even as the leaders of the world gather in New York City?
It's very clear that this embassy is playing a very important role. The fact that President Lula da Silva welcomed President Zelaya here into Brazilian territory in this embassy is such a gesture of incredible support. The fact that the foreign minister of Brazil was the one who insisted that the Security Council of the United Nations meet about this urgent situation, which will take place tomorrow. This request, I'm told, was joined by both Russia and the United States. So here in the embassy, the role that this place is the function really is to host the president and his detail, both his family, the security people who are with him, as well as those who have been supporting the resistance here for all of these months. One key figure here is Father Andres Tamayo, a Catholic priest who is dedicating 100% of his time to the resistance. And he, today, we opened with a circle of prayer in the embassy. It's basically a welcome place for the president and all of those who are able to be here, and the press. There's both international press and the domestic press here. Of course, one of the most important voices in this country is Radio Globo. They are constantly reporting on the repression of this coup regime, and they serve to give a lot of information to both here in the embassy and, of course, all across the country about what is happening.
Now, Andres, can I ask you to do something for us? Maybe you can try and take the program live and introduce us to a few of the people who are there inside the embassy. Maybe there's somebody who wants to talk to the Pacifica audience here and around the country.
I would be very happy to do that, Dennis. I'm going to take you to speak with Carlos Reina is right here in front of me. He does speak English, and I'm going to ask him to give you a little bit of his perspective. And we're here sitting at the table with President Zelaya at this moment. So let me hand the phone over to Carlos, and you can interview him.
Hello.
Hi, Carlos. This is Dennis Bernstein. You're on Pacifica Radio on the Flashpoint Show. Welcome to America.
Well, thank you.
And we know that you two are in the Americas with us, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. How did you end up in a place like that inside the Brazilian embassy surrounded by coup soldiers? What happened?
Well, I've been doing the same question to myself. I've been working very close to the President Zelaya
since a long time ago, because we believe in his project and we believe that his proposal of making a new constitution for Honduras is something that is going to give us better expectations to in the future. So I've been working very close to him. The day that he announced that he was back in Honduras, we came because we're part of his team. And we stayed with him, and we're going to be here at the Embassy of Brazil until he goes wherever he goes. If he's the president of Honduras, we're going to be with him over there. And whatever else, we also are going to be with him because he's our leader, and he is the person that we choose to give Honduras a better future.
Tell us about what was your work? How exactly were you working with the President Zelaya? What kinds of things do you do? Tell us about your background.
I've never been working at the government. I've been working in the party, in the Liberal Party of Honduras. In my family, the politics runs in the blood for more than 100 years. I had an uncle, Carlos Roberto Reina. He used to be the president of Honduras from 1994 and 1998. In that government, Presidente Zelaya was named as Minister of social investment, and he did such a good work over there that gave him the opportunity to run in the next term to the president, and that's why we've been close to him for a long time ago.
Let me ask you this, Carlos Reina. We know that there has been a lot of violence in the street. Some people have been killed by the security forces. We know President Zelaya is very upset about this. Have you spoken to him about it? Could you share a bit of the kinds of feelings, what's going through his mind about this stuff?
Well, it's not a surprise for us what is happening, because we know what these people are capable of. Well, remember the June 28th. They do something that we also think that it was history, and they bring back that horrible history and put it again in the land of Central America. So we believe that these people, they don't know what are they doing. They're blind. And because they're blind, they don't understand that they're doing so much evil to our country. And that's why the people don't like them. You know, in Honduras, 92% of the population is against the coup. 92%, and 70% of the population support President Zelaya. So we have a president that, for the first time in a long time, the poor people of Honduras, they have hope again. They hope that in this presidency and the changes that he is talking about, he can really do something to change the perspective of their lives. Because in Honduras, you have to know that when you're born in a poor family in the country, you're going to be poor in the country, and your sons are going to be poor in the country. There is no hope. But now he awoke hope in people.
All right, Carlos Reina, we thank you. A friend to the president, President Zelaya, talking to us from inside the Brazilian embassy. And has the president heard from the coup government, heard from Micheletti, any attempt to have a peaceful dialogue?
Well, he's calling for the dialogue, and their answer was bombs, shots, violence, repression, all that. They didn't talk. They didn't say anything. Just golpes. Just beating the people. But we hope that tomorrow, with the help of the UNO, they're going to talk about Honduras. They're going to call the Security Council of the UNO Things are going to change.
All right, Carlos Reyna, a friend.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, a friend and aide
to President. Say hello to everybody from Honduras living in California, okay?
Thank you so much for being with us. Adios. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio live inside the Brazilian embassy, surrounded by coup forces on the outside and President Zelaya on the inside. And Andres, are you back on that telephone?
I hope. Dennis, I'm standing right here in front of the president if you would like to greet him.
Yes, I would love to. Thank you.
Welcome,
President. Please say thank you for joining us. Welcome, and we appreciate your time and your courage.
Señor Presidente, bienvenido y apreciamos su tiempo y su valor. Está en inglés.
Gracias y estamos siempre pendientes de la solución de este problema, sin importar el esfuerzo que haya que hacer.
Thank you so much, and we are really appreciative of your concern for this problem that we have here in Honduras, knowing that you do so out of your heart.
Mr. President, could you please share some of your concerns about the violence that has taken place against the citizens of Honduras by the military supported coup?
Sobre la violencia contra el pueblo de Honduras, la barbaridad que han cometido.
Bueno, los que dan el golpe de Estado son simples mandaderos de una élite económica que hay en Honduras, que tiene el monopolio de las principales actividades económicas del país.
So the ones who are committing these atrocities of human rights are those who belong to an elite oligarchy who have benefited from the kinds of monopolies that have led them to have so much economic power.
And in terms of why you returned, why you walked back into the city and let the people know that you were back, what's at the core? Why did you do it?
¿Y por qué, señor presidente, es que usted volvió a Honduras en sí?
Bueno, porque yo no renuncio a mis derechos ni al derecho del pueblo de luchar por una vida mejor para los hondureños.
It's because I, as president, do not resign as my role of president of this country, nor do I allow the people of Honduras, nor do I see the people of Honduras resigning in front of the repression that they are facing.
Mr. President, what is your plan now? What is your hope for the future?
¿Cuál es su plan ahora, señor presidente? ¿Cuál es su esperanza para el futuro?
Mi plan es luchar porque el régimen golpista firme el plan Arias y acepte las resoluciones de la OEA y Naciones Unidas.
My struggle now is that the golpista, the coup regime, sign the accord that was negotiated in San Jose, and that they accept the declarations that were adopted by both the United Nations and the Organization of American States. I think we have one more possibility here, Dennis.
And finally, what would you like the people of the United States, if you were speaking to the United Nations, Mr. President, what would you say?
Si usted podría hablar finalmente a las Naciones Unidas, ¿qué sería el mensaje en sí?
Que las Naciones Unidas deben de dar un fuerte mensaje a la humanidad para que los golpes de Estado queden como crímenes de guerra.
My message would primarily be that the United Nations give the strong and irrevocable message that coups d'etat are crimes against humanity.
All right. Thank you, Mr. President, for your time. We wish you the best of luck in the future.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Okay, great, Dennis.
All right, thank you. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That was President Manuel Zelaya speaking with our Flashpoint show from inside the Brazilian embassy inside of Tegucigalpa, Honduras. He has returned to the country to restore democracy. The embassy, the Brazilian embassy, is surrounded by security forces. And so far, there's been no dialogue, only, as we heard, bombs, bullets, tear gas, and the like. Andres, that was amazing. We appreciate that. That's Andres Conteras reporting from inside the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa. Andres, incredible work. I want to tell people you work with Democracy Now in Espanol. You are associated with Nonviolence International, and you are a longtime human rights activist, and we do appreciate the good work you're doing for the Pacifica Radio Network and for the listeners who count on a real alternative to the mainstream. So please be careful. And we will talk to you soon. Did you have a final comment, please?
I just want to say thank you, Dennis. It's an honor for me to be able to be on Flashpoints and on KPFA in general.
We thank you for being with us on Flashpoints.
Likewise. A big hug to everyone.
This is about some of the most marginalized people on earth. Fighting one of the most powerful companies in the world.
When you look at the science, they cannot really prove their case.
In fact, we're having a trial. It's a miracle. It's a huge victory.
Sounds from crude, the real price of oil, and it really is a battle of our time. One of the most important face-offs between this massive oil company called Chevron and the people who are trying to protect their homeland. An amazing documentary. It opens, I guess it's moving around the country. It opens in the Bay Area tomorrow. And we thought that in the context of the Honduran people rising up to restrain the United States government, which of course comes along with all the corporations, that's what it's about. And it's hard to figure out whether Hillary Clinton is into diplomacy or corporate free trade policies. But it doesn't look like she's cared that much about democracy, and she certainly hasn't been outspoken, I guess, about the situation in Ecuador. Let me tell you who is joining us now. We've got in the studio Paul Pazzi Mino. He's managing director of Amazon Watch. And I believe in one moment we will be joined by Joe Berlinger. He's a filmmaker, one of the filmmakers of Crude, the Real Price of Oil. Well, let me start with you, Paul. And maybe when we're talking about environmental damage, maybe you could give us a thumbnail sketch of what this looks like on the ground.
Sure, exactly. Well,
because I know you've been on the ground.
Yes, I have. And first, I want to thank you for having me back. It's good to be back on the show.
Thank you.
I've been down there. In fact, my family's from Ecuador, so I sort of grew up learning and hearing about this case. But I recently actually took a group of interested people to see for themselves the devastation in Ecuador. Amazon Watch takes rainforest delegations so that people can experience what's happened by Texaco, Chevron, and also see the remaining part of the Amazon that we're still trying to protect in the indigenous communities therein. And first, I should say that Amazon Watch is a nonprofit organization working to protect the rainforest and advance the rights of indigenous peoples in the Amazon basin. And we've been doing so since for 12, almost 13 years now. So Amazon Watch has been working on this campaign, the Clean Up Ecuador campaign, for several years. And the reason that this film is so powerful, not only because of its great story, and you'll hear from Joe about that, but because we're talking about sort of the greatest, essentially unknown case when it comes to environmental destruction and corporate accountability, or lack thereof.
And courage of people to stand up.
Exactly. And you heard that clip from Stephen saying the fact that they're having a trial is a miracle, because this is the first time that 30,000 indigenous people, individuals, have launched a class action lawsuit against a major multinational or transnational corporation. And of course, that's our own Chevron based here in California. And, you know, you asked me to talk about the numbers. It's staggering. It's impossible to really comprehend. We're talking about 18 billion gallons of toxic wastewater deliberately dumped into the Ecuadorian Amazon, an inhabited area, over the course of many years, and left there lying in waste pits to spill off continually over many years into the streams and waters where these communities lived and need to survive. So nothing like this has ever even been done before. Well, I should say, in Ecuador.
And there have been waves, decades of resistance.
Yes, this case started in 1992, as soon as Texaco left Ecuador, and they're still fighting this battle. And the waste pits are still there polluting to this day, which is the problem. And people need to be aware of the fact that this is a suit to push Chevron to clean up. This is not about lining the pockets of people. Certainly the 30,000 people in Ecuador, they're still living there. They need their environment cleaned. They need safe drinking water, and they need reparations for the people who've died and continue to die of cancer and medical treatment. And that's what this is about.
Paul, let me bring in, we managed to get a hold of the filmmaker Joe Berlinger. He joins us on the telephone. We're talking again about crude, the real price of oil. It opens up in the Bay Area, and don't have a lot of time, but Joe Berlinger, an amazing documentary that you put together. Why'd you do it?
Why'd I do it?
Why did you take this kind of commitment?
Good question. I mean, I kind of got dragged kicking and screaming into this story. I wasn't sure a film could be made. I was introduced to the case by the plaintiff's attorney, Stephen Donziger, and a lot of my filmmaker red flags went off about why I couldn't make a film, but he convinced me to go down and see the area. And once you go down there, man, it's just, the pollution is devastating. The impact on the indigenous people is shameful. On my second day of my trip, I pulled up by canoe to one of these Kofan villages that are profiled in the films, and people are sitting around eating canned tuna deep in the heart of the Amazon rainforest because the fish in their river are dead. And I went back home to New York, and I said to myself, how can I turn my back on what I was shown? And just felt like I would point to camera and see where it took us. I was embarrassed to be an American on that trip, and it really opened my eyes.
Well, put us through the lens of that camera. Tell us just a few of the images that, if you will, etch into your own lens. You know, you close your eyes, the camera is rolling, and your own camera is rolling on other things. What did you see once these images started to register?
Well, you know, actually, the funny thing is, I think one of the failings of the film is that it's only two-dimensional. The thing that I remember the most and stays with me the most is just the smell. People's drinking water smells like petroleum. You stand by these pits that have been left for three decades, and these noxious fumes come off it. You know, after an hour or two of filming, you know, we'd have to take a break because we'd have splitting headaches and watery eyes. It's just, you know, the Ecuadorian Amazon is one of the few places on Earth that survived the last ice age, and therefore it is an incredible laboratory of uncounted species and, biodiversity. And what I saw, it felt like this place was barely surviving 40 years of oil production. And, you know, this is a place that we should be cherishing and not destroying. And it's just, I was stunned at the disregard for the people who live there and for the environment itself.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.